People filtering in, please come grab any of the seats. My name is Travis McLeod. I'm the Chief Executive of the Centre for Policy Development, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's CPD Forum on Financing a Sustainable Economy. Can I start by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, one of the first sovereign nations of this continent and its adjacent islands, and can I please, on behalf of everyone, pay our respects to the elders of the past, the present, and especially the elders to come. It's wonderful to see so many of the Centre for Policy Development's network here this evening, including our newest board member, fresh from running the Premier's office in South Australia, Dr. Don Russell, other board members, members of our research committee, fellows, staff, and several supporters. It's also fantastic to see so many of the stakeholders we've consulted with in releasing our latest report earlier today, Climate Horizons, co-authored by Sam Hurley and Kate McKenzie, about which I'm sure you'll hear a bit more later. I'm biased, of course, but I think Sam and Kate have done a brilliant job. It's riveting reading on a wintry night in Sydney, especially because there's an excellent chapter contributed by ClimateWorks Australia and a checklist for boards prepared by Minters and others, which I'm sure you'll hear about tonight as well. Many people in the room have followed our work on climate risk, business and sustainability since the legal opinion we commissioned in 2016 that was authored by Noel Hutley, Senior Counsel, and Sebastian Hartford Davis. We're grateful to our hosts, Minter Ellison Lawyers, who were not only the advising and instructing solicitors on that opinion, led by Special Counsel Sarah Barker and partner Matt Gurgis, but who have also supported CPD since and are hosting tonight's event. So thank you, Sarah, Matt, and others. APRA's Jeff Summerhayes is here, who headlined a similar forum held in this room last November, and who, along with ASIC Commissioner John Price, who's our keynote speaker tonight, attended our business roundtable on these issues back in October 2016. I should mention that the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, Guy DeBell, is also in the House tonight, which made me wonder whether I should tell a witty joke about what happened when three regulators walked into a law firm. But you'll be relieved to know that I couldn't think of a good punchline, certainly none that were appropriate for tonight. Maybe as the Q&A gets more creative, I'll give you my two best efforts. But thank you all for coming. You're all distinguished guests, and it's a very informed and interested audience tonight. So thank you for coming in such inclement weather. It's a little-known fact that one of the other participants in the inaugural roundtable we held on these issues in October 2016, also hosted by Minters in Melbourne, was former High Court Justice Ken Hayne. Little did he and all of us know at that point, when he joked about being very happily retired, that a little over 12 months later, he'd be appointed to head the Financial Services Royal Commission. Now, as you'll know, the Royal Commission has been tasked with inquiring into whether, among other things, the conduct, practices, behaviour or business activities by financial services entities falls below community standards and expectations. By coincidence, one of the matters the Royal Commission is hearing evidence on next week in Brisbane is natural disaster insurance in remote and regional communities. And one of the case studies listed for investigation is Tropical Cyclone Debbie from March 2017. Those of you who came last November to our forum here will remember that Jeff, one of the facts that he cited was that the insured losses from Cyclone Debbie made it the second most costly cyclone of the past 50 years. Whether climate risk is a matter the Royal Commission turns its attention to remains to be seen. But regardless of that, it's certainly a subject that we will turn our attention to this evening. Tonight's a chance for us to discuss the latest developments in climate risk and how these have been connected to an emerging domestic and international agenda on sustainable finance. And we're delighted to have John here to kick off that conversation with a keynote speech. John has been an ASIC commissioner since 2012. Earlier this year, his term was extended by a further 2 years. John is a lawyer by training. He worked in the Brisbane and Gold Coast offices of a rival firm, Coles Chambers Westgarth, before joining ASIC. He now has over 15 years of regulatory experience at ASIC, working in a variety of roles relating to policymakers, mergers and acquisitions, financial services and products, financial reporting and auditing. John, by virtue of his position, is also an advisor on many bodies to government. He serves on the Financial Reporting Council and is also a member of the Council of Financial Regulators, the coordinating body for Australia's main financial regulatory agencies, which now, as you'll know, has a climate risk working group. As such, John has a comprehensive view of the regulatory landscape in Australia and a clear sense of where it's likely to head. From what we know and understand, tonight marks the first time an ASIC commissioner has given a dedicated speech on this subject. So would you please make John very welcome.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Now, can I just check, can the people at the back hear me okay? Fantastic, that's a good start. Well, look, good evening. I'm very pleased to be here tonight to speak at this forum, and I do want to thank the Centre for Policy Development for the invitation for me to share ASIC's views on this increasingly topical issue of climate risk. So while preparing my comments for tonight, I did reflect on some remarks that I recently delivered in Melbourne to the Audit and Risk Committee Forum just last month. And in particular, a quote that I drew from the Deloitte Global Human Capital Trends Report of 2018. Now, in that report, Deloitte made the following observation based on a global survey of 11,000 businesses and HR leaders, as well as interviews with executives from leading organisations. And this is what Deloitte said. We believe that a fundamental change is underway. Organisations are no longer assessed based only on traditional metrics such as financial performance or even the quality of their products or services. Rather, organisations today are increasingly judged on the basis of their relationships with their workers, their customers, and their communities, as well as their impact on society at large, transferring them from business enterprises into social enterprises. Now, while the primary focus of Deloitte's report was human capital, its conclusion is instructive and it resonates with the subject matter of my address tonight. We continue to see, both internationally and in our own market, an increasing focus on company matters that sit outside of traditional evaluative metrics, and in particular, those matters concerning the environment, sustainability or governance. Now, I think the evidence for that is very clear. For starters, you are all here this evening to hear and discuss, amongst other things, climate risk and attendant disclosures. Moreover, our own general work in the corporate governance area has highlighted that the increasing market focus on ESG issues, from shareholder resolutions put forward at general meetings, right through to the continued emergence of investors with a specific ESG-related investment focus, mandate or benchmark. I'll come back to this broad theme towards the end of my remarks, but I thought it would be useful to touch on it at the outset because it does speak very clearly, I think, to the changing environment that companies are operating in and the evolving context which directors need to consider important governance-related issues, including the risks and opportunities of climate change. So with that in mind, I'd like to move on to climate risk specifically. And perhaps it would be helpful at the outset for me to identify at a high level ASIC's key priorities in this area before spending a little bit of time unpacking each of these issues a little further. Firstly, we're focused on encouraging strong and effective corporate governance. We consider that the prudent and appropriate management of issues such as climate change, be it climate risk or climate opportunity, begins with the core fundamentals of corporate governance. That is, integrity, transparency, accountability, and acting for a proper purpose. And we think this, in particular, must be led by directors and senior managers within companies. Secondly, ASIC's focused on disclosure. Where the law requires disclosure of climate risk, we're strongly focused on ensuring that the law is complied with in a way that is both useful and relevant to the market. So let me dig into these issues a little more. Corporate governance. Now, in terms of governance, we know from our regulatory experience that companies that have a strong and culture and effective corporate governance practices are better equipped to develop and implement effective strategies to manage both risks and opportunities. And this, of course, applies to climate risk, just as it does to other risks, such as conduct risks, cybersecurity risks, or risks around digital disruption. We at ASIC have stressed this point time and again. This starts with directors, who are very important gatekeepers in our financial system. Good corporate governance should be a very important part of a director's mindset when discharging his or her functions, and it's intrinsically linked with a strong corporate culture more generally. As the end of financial year approaches, we again take the opportunity to encourage directors to take a proactive approach to strategy and risk management. Directors, I think, need to understand and continually reassess existing and emerging risks that may be applicable to their business and ask the relevant questions of management. This should extend to both short-term and longer-term risks and opportunities and financial risks, but importantly, non-financial risks as well. Indeed, directors, I think, would do well to carefully consider the memorandum of opinion previously mentioned by Noel Hutley and Sebastian Hartford-Davis on climate change and directors' duties, which was commissioned some time ago by the host of tonight's event. As many of you would no doubt be aware, the authors of that opinion observed that, amongst other things, that it is, and I quote, conceivable that directors who fail to consider climate change risks now could be found liable for breaching their duty of care and diligence in the future. Now, while matters such as this, in the end, will be determined by a court, we think that the Hutley opinion is relatively unremarkable. And I say that in the sense that, in my view, the opinion appears to be legally sound and reflective of our own understanding of the position under the prevailing case law in Australia so far as directors' duties are concerned. Of course, the question of whether or not an entity is ultimately materially exposed to climate risk must be determined having regard to the particular circumstances that apply in each entity's case. However, the Hutley opinion highlights and reinforces the need for directors to adopt a probative and proactive approach in assembling the information reasonably required to inform their decision-making in this area. And depending on the circumstances, it may be difficult for the directors who have not even considered the issue to later seek to invoke the business judgment rule. Let me move to the topic of disclosure. As I mentioned earlier, we're strongly focused on ensuring that where the law requires it, companies disclose material climate change risks. In fact, in an ASIC report published earlier this year, we highlighted some of the key areas where we have set out our views, and this includes our policy and regulatory guide 247, which sets out our view that the law requires an operating and financial review of a company, a listed entity, to include a discussion of environmental and other sustainability risks, including climate risks, where those risks could affect the entity's achievement of its financial performance or outcomes that it's disclosed to the market. Secondly, I think it's important to remember that for companies seeking to raise funds under a prospectus, the law requires the disclosure of all information that investors and their professional advisors would reasonably require to make an informed assessment of the prospects of the company. Now, in some cases, climate change risk or opportunity will be material to a company's prospects and must be disclosed in a prospectus in a clear, concise, and effective way to ensure that investors are able to make fully informed decisions. And our policy and regulatory guide 228, which further discusses prospectuses generally, sets out further detail and explicitly addresses the disclosure of environmental and regulatory risks in prospectuses. Of course, in addition to these, the law may require climate risk to be disclosed in other contexts, such as by way of continuous disclosure announcement or elsewhere, and we have a range of existing guidance to assist our regulated population in complying with their statutory obligations. But if there's one thing I want you to remember tonight, it's the following. It is not just strict legal requirements that should be front of mind here. Companies should also carefully consider the general information needs of investors. Now, the voluntary disclosure framework, and framework generally, developed by the Task Force on Climate Change, the TCFD, may help companies and advisors in considering how to disclose climate change-related risks and opportunities and what type of information to disclose, both where there's an obligation under law and in circumstances where a company voluntarily discloses additional information, such as in a sustainability report. Indeed, as many of you here tonight would be aware, a number of Australian listed companies are already announcing their intention to report or have commenced reporting under the task force framework. And we're closely monitoring developments in this regard, and we have been and intend to continue engaging with key stakeholders on this issue and, of course, adopt a consultative approach as market conduct evolves and improves over time. Now, ASIC has heard feedback from some stakeholders who are concerned about the implications of the task force recommendations and, in particular, concerns around director liability for forward-looking statements. And we've heard that this concern may be a reason why some boards are reluctant to fully adopt TCFD reporting to the market, particularly in relation to the scenario analysis components. Now, these concerns are understandable, I think, given the uncertainties surrounding future climate risk impacts. And of course, I'd point out that the TCFD did not go so far as setting a standard approach and the existing tools and resources for judging impacts on climate risks are obviously still evolving. However, notwithstanding these issues, I do want to state tonight that as a general proposition, we do not consider that the law or our policy would impede an entity from undertaking climate risk scenario analysis. Likewise, we do not think that director liability should be a major impediment to reporting under the TCFD framework, provided that the modelling used adopts reasonable assumptions and inputs and discloses those in full. Now, this can be achieved by making sure that the disclosure is the product of a robust assessment of the best evidence available to a company at the time. More generally, we encourage companies and directors to carefully consider the TCFD's report, not just in the disclosure context, but as a key resource to assist in understanding, identifying, and managing climate risk and climate opportunity. Now, in addition to our core priorities, we're also considering climate change and climate risk in another of other contexts that I'll highlight very briefly. We've commenced a review of our relevant regulatory guidance to ensure that it continues to provide an appropriate principles and high-level guide that stakeholders can apply in meeting their disclosure obligations under the Corporations Act. The government's response to the Senate Economics References Committee on Climate Risk encouraged ASIC to do just this, and we're hoping to finalise our review and respond to the market certainly before the year is out. In addition to that, through IOSCO, an international organisation of securities regulators from all around the world, we continue to participate in discussions with our international peers about reporting of environmental and sustainability risks more broadly, and we are monitoring international developments such as the recent release of the European Commission's Action Plan on Financing Sustainable Growth. We're also continuing our focus on impairment testing and asset values in our upcoming review of 30 June 2018 financial reports. And as we've noted elsewhere, in some cases, climate change may affect asset values. We're also undertaking a review of climate change-related disclosures across companies in the ASX 300 to better understand current market practices. And again, our current intention is to publish these findings later on this year. And more broadly, as has been mentioned, a climate risk working group has been established under the auspices of the Council of Financial Regulators. And we're participating in this working group along with our colleagues at APRA, the Reserve Bank, and Treasury to help ensure a coordinated response to climate risk and its potential impact on our financial system and markets more broadly. Now, before closing to ask for any questions this evening, I'd like to return to the bigger picture, and in particular a theme I've spoken about before recently and loosely touched on earlier this evening. And that theme is about a company's social licence to operate. Now, in a discussion paper on shareholder primacy released back in 2014, the Governance Institute of Australia observed the following, and I quote, "In the 21st century, the relationship between business and society is considered an implicit social contract. For reasons of ethics and enlightened self-interest, those companies alert to the longer-term impact of social issues and in a constant dialogue with their stakeholders have a competitive advantage. Shifts in social issues that ultimately feed into the fundamental drivers of corporate performance generate value creation opportunities. Focusing on a business-is-business approach can lead managers to emphasise short-term company performance while neglecting longer-term opportunities and issues. There is, therefore, considerable incentive for a company to conduct its business in a socially responsible manner." Now, Deloitte's more recent observation, to which I referred to earlier this evening, builds on this and speaks of a fundamental change in the way that companies are being evaluated. For some company stakeholders, the social and environmental impact of corporate activity is an increasingly acute criterion considered in deciding which company to invest in or do business with. A salient question for boards and directors to now ask, therefore, might be, how do we identify the risks and opportunities presented by this new environment and respond in a manner that is both consistent with the social contract under which we operate and nurturing of longer-term business success? For our part, we'll continue to encourage boards and directors to ask these questions of themselves and shine a light on their own culture and corporate governance practices, two critical drivers which we believe are critical in answering that question. Thank you for your attention this evening, and I'm more than happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. John has very kindly agreed to take a couple of questions before we move to the panel. Has anyone got a question? Yes.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
How do you relate AGL and the controversy over the Liddell power station in the criteria you've been discussing?
So I think it's important to remember that it's not ASIC's business in looking at culture to micromanage the culture of boards or the risk decisions they make. I'd hark back to my closing comments. I think it's very important for businesses themselves to consider what their own approach is to social contract issues and their risk appetite around these issues. Now, we, as a regulator, are happy to advocate for what we think is best practice, and I think the TCFD voluntary disclosure regime and thoughts more generally about governance do outline a powerful model against which to assess climate issues. But ultimately, these questions will rest fundamentally with the board. Of course, where someone crosses the line in terms of directors' duties, in terms of breaches of disclosure obligations, our role is to enforce the law, and the Australian public would expect no less of us.
One from here, Narelle. You can jump in early as moderator, and Kate McKenzie as well. We'll take those two, and then
John, can you just run by that last statement you made in terms of the review of the annual reports? Thank you. the review of the annual reports as it will be doing later this year. I understand what you're looking for.
Yeah, so we are having a look at what disclosures have been made in the Australian market around climate change related issues. This is similar for those of you who are familiar with various international activities to a review that was done in Canada recently, looking at some of the large listed entities there. And what we're looking to do is, first of all, to see whether there's any disclosure around climate risks, but also the robustness of that disclosure. Does it look like boilerplate disclosure? How far along the maturity curve has the disclosure moved? And we think that's important because transparency is a very important part of our market. So both to highlight good practices and bad practices, it's useful to conduct that surveillance review across ASX 300 listed companies more broadly, is our feeling.
You mentioned some of the developments overseas, like the EU Sustainable Finance Action and also that IOSCO, you're involved through IOSCO in looking at how these issues around climate risk are emerging internationally. Particularly with relation to those two bodies, the EU is adopting, is sort of moving to a point where they're adopting standards and taxonomy. Well, not adopting them, but they've committed to developing them and adopting them.
Yeah.
And also clear expectations around incorporating sort of sustainability, but again, the focus will be mostly on climate, into the obligations on asset managers, asset owners.
Yep.
It seems that in Australia, the thinking in the Australian kind of regulatory framework, the thinking is still more around voluntary disclosure. But if we're seeing other jurisdictions move towards not so much mandatory reporting yet, but it does seem that that's certainly been flagged in some jurisdictions and moving to official defined, official standards and obligations, that seems quite a bit ahead of or quite kind of further out than Australia is. How do you think ASIC and your sort of fellow regulators will be able to keep up with that, or is that...
So one important thing I think I'd probably call out at the outset is, of course, the ASIC's Corporate Governance Council is, as we speak, consulting on new guidance and principles in terms of its comply or explain framework. Now, that does cover some issues around climate change. As you're aware, the submission date for that particular piece of work closes at the end of July. So there's an opportunity to input into that now, and if you have a strong interest, I'd encourage you to do so. More broadly, in terms of sustainable finance-related questions and whether or not there needs to be some sort of taxonomy, so if that decision is to be made, that will ultimately need to be a decision of government and reflected through legislation. I think that's a very important point. What I would say, however, is that in the interim, there are still important laws that apply in Australia, and those laws relate to misleading or deceptive conduct. So I think whatever standards people are using today in relation of whether a particular investment is sustainable or not, or what its labelling is, people need to bear those obligations in mind. Because I have seen in other contexts people trip up. For example, suddenly moving classification of a particular issue to something else to meet performance-related aspirations. It's very important to remember those misleading or deceptive laws still apply more generally, even if there's not a specific taxonomy here in Australia.
One more. Yes, gentlemen at the front, before we... And there'll be, by the way, we'll have plenty of time in the panel to go over some of these comments. Draw John back in if we need to. So, yes, gentlemen with the...
Hi.
Can you just say who... Can you mind saying who you are and where you're from?
Dan Gersher from the ACCR. The TCFD outlined a number of sectors that were essentially at high risk of physical climate risk.
Yep.
But we've seen in the last kind of 6 to 12 months companies that wouldn't necessarily fit into those sectors be susceptible to climate risk. Mm. And I'm thinking Maya, Tadcorp.
Yeah.
What is the incentive is there for those companies, or how are those companies going to be pushed into disclosing climate risks?
Well, I think the incentive, well, two answers. First of all, I go back to my comments about social contract, and I think doing the right thing can be, and having a positive culture can be very important for your business. So if you like, that's the carrot. In terms of the stick, as I said, the Noel Hutley opinion I found to be relatively unremarkable. And I don't mean that in a nasty way. I mean, it seems to me these are foreseeable risks. These are foreseeable risks. And as such, I think it's important that company directors are turning their mind to it. And indeed, I know from perusing the Australian Company Directors website on many occasions that it is an issue that is the subject of some discussion with the director community. So I think directors would be well advised to be aware of these risks in order to protect their company and indeed their own position as directors. Thanks.
Thank you. John, thank you very much for a powerful speech, ending with that wonderful note about the broader contract between business and society at large, which you echoed just now in the closing, but a lot of detail that no doubt will be poured over in the coming days about not just the unremarkable Hutley opinion and from your perspective, but also ASIC's other priorities around the international work, the mapping of disclosure from the ASX 300 over the next 6 months, the work with fellow regulators, etc. So thank you for giving us such a substantive amount of material from which to work. And it's appropriate, given that you just mentioned the Australian Institute of Company Directors, that we have the editor-in-chief of their magazine, Company Director Narelle Hooper, to come up now and moderate an outstanding panel. And if I can invite Narelle, the other panellists are Sam Hurley, Dom Giuliano, Anna Scarbeck and Sarah Barker to please come up on stage as well.
Thank you. Taking seats, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming, everybody. And it's the true believers tonight that the weather out there is phenomenal. I don't have an answer for what happens when you have three regulators walking into the room, except you have RBA, ASIC, and APRA, on top of TCFD, and a bunch of other acronyms. I think we've got alphabet soup. But and warning tonight, a slight jargon alert. So many of you are familiar with these issues, but in case, just let us know if you need to understand more. My name is Narelle Hooper. I'm delighted to be here to facilitate this discussion and to bring you all into this towards the end. Three issues we want to get into tonight, and one is just looking at the policy and regulatory changes over the past 18 months or so. How the TCFDs, this idea of scenario analysis, is helping to come to grips with some of the areas of risk and opportunity. And the biggest steps that sustainable finance and the actions of companies in Australia can help us move towards. So I just wanted to pick up on John's comments regarding social licence, but equally the foreseeable risks, and that struck me quite heavily, that. Our panellists, to my left, we have Anna Scarbeck, the CEO of ClimateWorks Australia, and ClimateWorks works in partnership across the private, public and not-for-profit sectors on ways to drive a low-carbon economic transition in Australia. Now, to Anna's left is Sarah Barker, the Special Counsel at Minter Ellison, and thanks for your hospitality, Sarah. Sarah's an expert on climate risk and corporate law, lucky that, and she was in Australia as solicitor on the Hutley opinion as well. She recently contributed that very important set of papers by the Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative on the legal position on climate risk in Australia and other Commonwealth nations. She does teach at the Company Directors course as well, so she's been informing our work on that. But, thank you very much. Now, to Sarah's left is Dom Giuliano, the Deputy Chief Investment Officer at Magellan Financial Group. And it's an ASX-listed investor with a focus on global equities and listed infrastructure. Now, over the last couple of years, they've developed and introduced a global low-carbon strategy as part of its broader offering. Welcome, Don. And then right to the far corner of the panel, we have Sam Hurley, the Policy Director of CPD, which commissioned the Hutley Opinion on Directors' Duties to consider climate risk, and CPD has been pushing very constructively in this space with the regulators, companies and with government. So thank you, Sam. And you also authored the CPD report on climate scenario analysis, which is out today. And I'd just like to say I've had a quick look through, this is the appendix to that. It's a really handy checklist for organisations that looks at governance, strategy, risk management and the metrics and targets. So I commend you for that. I think it's a really important piece of work. So thank you. So lots to discuss. And let's begin on just reflecting initially on John's comments and then part of how climate risk is starting to shift into the wider consciousness of not just in our own kind of perspective as humans, but on value and risk for the financial sector and institutions. Sam, I'll kick off with you. I was very interested to hear what John had to say. How significant are those remarks tonight? And the statements in response to climate risk from financial regulators in the broader context of that, please.
Thanks, Sarah, welcome and thanks for coming along tonight. Thank you also for not describing me as being on the far left of the
That would be too easy.
And I'll get
as I'm learning, the best policy comes from all directions.
And I'll get some other words of thanks out of the way while I'm at it. Thank you for your kind words about the report, which I co-authored with Kate McKenzie, one of CPD's fellows. And I'd like to thank ClimateWorks and Sarah Barker for their contributions to that report, including the excellent checklist, which you mentioned, the REL, which Sarah and her team provided, which is a great resource, as is the rest of the report, speaking from a slightly biased point of view. So on to John's remarks. I mean, I think there was a lot of really important material in John's remarks tonight. I'm going through my notes quickly. A few of the key things that jumped out to me were the statement about the clear relevance of the Hutley opinion and the foreseeability of some of the risks which we're all so interested in and concerned about. Strong statement of support for the role of TCFDs in that context, especially around disclosure. The fact that as ASIC sees it, there's no barrier to scenario analysis under the Corporations Act in terms of areas where companies might trip themselves up about forward-looking statements. The review of ASX 300 disclosures, responding to the Senate committee report by the end of the year, I mean, these are all really important developments. I think what's more significant, potentially, than any one of those developments alone is the fact that, Australia's companies and financial services law regulator is here tonight talking in a very concerted, constructive way about how all these different initiatives and risks tie together. And I think more than that, the fact that the statements that ASIC have made tonight are consistent with a bunch of really, effective, concerted leadership on these issues by regulators in Australia across the board now. I mean, it's easy to forget that only 18 months ago, Australia was in a position where none of our financial regulators had made any of these kinds of statements about climate change and how climate change impacts risks for companies and investors and for the financial sector. But over the last 18 months, beginning with some important speeches made by APRA's Jeff Summer-Hayes, who's here tonight, who spoke at our event last year, and continuing with John's remarks tonight, what we've seen is a very consistent, measured approach and some really constructive leadership from some of Australia's key regulators on these issues. I think that's really important. I think a couple of quick caveats to that, though, are that that role has been really essential in moving the conversation forward. I think it's also fair to say that we can't expect regulators, financial regulators in Australia, to do it all. I mean, I think
just want to stop you there. Why do you think it's moved so quickly in that short space of time?
I think there have been a lot of factors in that. I mean, there have been some really important developments internationally. The entry into force of the Paris Agreement, which goes directly to this issue of foreseeability of climate-related risks. The steady march of the science on climate change and climate impacts, has an important role. The emergence of the TCFDs is this really influential voluntary business-led framework, led at a really senior level by some very influential people in the business community. That's been a factor. in Australia, things like the Hutley opinion have helped to kind of elevate the conversation and bring some more momentum to these issues, and this very careful leadership from regulators who see the ways in which some of these risks might manifest for companies and for the financial sector across the board. So I think all those things have kind of added up. I think it's safe to say it's also been a long time coming. And I suppose that gets me back to my...
Well, okay, why has it taken so
long? Yeah, and that gets, gets me back to my point about like the slight caveats, I suppose, in my response. We can't expect financial regulators to do it all. And the most effective role they can play, and a role that they are playing now, is providing some clarity and guidance so that business can have a proper crack at this and so that policymakers can too, because at the end of the day, they're the two things that we're going to need to see to get better responses. I think the second caveat is, as John put it tonight, in a sense, some of this is unremarkable, not in the sense that it's not important, but that it seems, especially now that it's all out in the open, quite obvious that companies should be responding to the financial impacts of climate change. That these things might manifest, that these kind of really big transitions that we're facing in our economy and in our physical environment might manifest in a way that's relevant to the financial system. That seems quite controversial and straightforward, and it's in a way surprising that it's taken the amount of time that it has for us to be having a kind of coherent conversation about those things, which I think just reflects the political environment that we've been in for the last 5 or 6 years. But it's great to see it happening now.
Sarah, I'll just pick up, because you were so instrumental in the Hutley opinion, can you just give us a quick recap on the legal situation and as far as company directors go when it comes to risk and climate?
Sure. Well, company directors have three main sets of duty. The first is to act in the best interest of the company. The second is to exercise due care and diligence. And the third is around disclosure and making sure that any disclosures by the company are not misleading or deceptive and present a true and fair view of a company's financial performance and also their prospects. So I think historically the way that climate change has been an input into the director's duties conversation has been a subset of that first bit of the duties, which is best interests. Is it in the best interests of our company to have regard to climate change? And historically, the answer to that was no, because of the fact it was pigeonholed as a lefty, greeny, hippie environmental issue. But in the last decade, where we've demonstrably seen a shift to climate risk having financial implications, the answer to that question is absolutely, it's in the best interest of the corporation to have regard to it. So first duty, you have to have regard to it. Second part of the duties, what is due care and diligence in having regard to climate risk, which is where the Hutley opinion shifted the focus to, I think. To be saying, yes, it is a foreseeable risk, so therefore you have to have regard to it, and you have to exercise due care and diligence, robust process, proactivity, in considering how it impacts on your business. And in the third set, which relates to disclosure, and particularly in relation to annual reporting, is another area that I think the next 12 months we're going to see a lot of movement in relation to, because it is the subject of the TCFD recommendations, and certainly I think John's comments tonight reflected the fact that it is basically Volandatree, I like to say.
Volandatree.
In terms of being a voluntary instrument that is really influential. It is being referred to by regulators. It's being referred to by investors. So if you are a director who is thinking about materiality through the lens of what information does an investor reasonably need to make a decision about whether to invest with me, it's undeniable that it's information that they need.
So what's your sense now in director land? Is the penny dropping yet? Has it started to? Well, compared to a few months ago since the opinion came in, for example.
And I can answer that both with my director hat on and with both and my corporate lawyer hat on. The trajectory of change in the last 2 years has been very, very steep. prior to that, if I was in a boardroom talking about climate change, it would be, well, A, why are we talking about this lefty hippie green issue? And B, why is a corporate lawyer talking to us about this lefty hippie green issue? The penny now seems to have dropped, certainly I think amongst larger corporations. Maybe you could put a general blanket across the ASX 50, say, where directors understand that it is a material financial risk that they need to have regard to. But we're now at the point where they're considering, well, what do we do? How do we grapple with it? It's also uncertain and hard and, you know, can someone just give me a box to tick, which, of course, isn't duly careful and diligent. But that's the point that we're at now, I think, where directors now understand it's something that needs to be given their full attention, but they are still struggling with how to do that and what it means.
Okay, we'll dive into that in a little bit more. Anna, you're at that intersection of corporates, governance. You're seeing what's out there. How are the conversations changing from what you're hearing? And is that sort of catching up with where they need to be?
Yes. Since the Paris Agreement was signed and these other developments have occurred all within the same sort of the last 1.5 to 2 years, there are much higher quality questions coming from much higher quality parties. And I think that shows that for large corporates and large financial institutions, the penny has more than dropped and action has begun. Mm-hmm. We've worked with big four banks here, investing in serious effort to understand what does the Paris Agreement mean for their lending portfolios and then acting on, you know, taking considered responses to that and acting on it. We've seen a lot more notice being taken of what's happening around the world. We've heard already the international regulators are watching as well, and so is the international money. So a lot of the North American and European pension funds and investors, which drive a lot of the shareholder activity here, are well ahead and are now seeing this as the norm and the expectation.
Okay. So is there potential for that to cascade through the big four, for example, of the banks here looking at their portfolios, their loan portfolios? To what degree do you see a potential for that to cascade through quite quickly?
I'm quite hopeful about that because it's through the big four banks, much of corporate Australia is influenced, mm-hmm. but it's also not just the big four banks who are taking notice of TCFD and what the Paris Agreement means more broadly and social licence, but supply chains everywhere are now. So some of those global brands are imposing these standards, whether the TCFD affects them or not. If you think McDonald's making announcements to only deal with supply chain if it doesn't involve deforestation. Meat and Livestock Australia now recognising that the red meat industry needs to be carbon neutral within 15 years. We've had the Modern Slavery Act. So particularly in the carbon neutral realm, there are a lot of multinationals making 100% renewable pledges within the next 5 to 7 years, which is now flowing through into corporate PPA buying here, for example. So I think through the supply chains, through the financial institutions, it can reach the rest of the economy more broadly.
Okay. I'm looking at the weight of the money here, and I'm looking right at you, Dom. You've just come back from London and comparing notes with investors over there. And you've previously spoken about the role of those big investors to drive change on this. I think we'll come a bit more into the detail of that, but I just wanted a quick check with you. How important have those investors been? We've seen the regulators' impact here, in the role of those investors in driving this momentum.
I think they're a crucial part of the equation, and there's a wide spectrum of investors and what they need to do and what their time horizons are like, and I think that's very important to bear in mind and how that bears back to scenario analysis. And so when you start thinking about some of the largest investors on the planet, so the world's largest sovereign wealth fund that looks after Norway's sovereign wealth. They are actively looking at this issue and encouraging and engaging with their investee companies to disclose and to provide more information. I was actually at the Responsible Investor Conference in London a couple of weeks ago, and the lady from Norges, the sovereign wealth fund, commenting on disclosures, etc. Her comment was fewer words, more numbers when it comes to disclosures, which I thought was a very interesting, neat, succinct summary as to where we need to get at. But they are absolutely pivotal in driving this change, because at the end of the day, through the engagement process, they are speaking with company directors and saying, hey, we actually care about this. And so it's beginning to have a waterfall effect through.
Okay. And is that more about carbon risk per se, or is there a broader issue around
that? It's a wide spectrum of issues. But carbon is a particular secular issue which impacts all firms on the planet, ultimately. So there's a particular focus on climate-related risks, and indeed, you know, the TCFD exists for a reason and reflects those
risks.
And
it's more around that as being a good indicator as long-term, a management team taking a long-term approach to the stewardship of a company and boards that sit around that.
Yeah, look, that's...
You're looking a bit sceptical.
No, well... I think one of the biggest issues that need to be dealt with here, and obviously the regulators and the corporate and the shareholder environment play a very big part in all of this, is simply agency risk. The fact that most executives are employed for a 5-year, 10-year tenure, if you're lucky, and the issues that we're actually dealing with here are 20, 30, 50, 100 years in scope, and the liabilities, pension savings, also have a 50, 60, 70 year duration and scope. There's a fundamental mismatch between the alignment of interests, and so it's something which really needs to be worked on, and hopefully TCFD and some of the disclosures and the scenario analysis can actually help level the playing field to a degree on the agency risk issues.
Just finding that quite ironic, given the original purpose of having the board and management and aligning everybody's interests in one direction. The notion we've described here about boards being the keeper of culture and this long-term attitude becomes increasingly important.
Yes. But there's quite a journey to get there, and TCFD and the scenario analysis discussion is a significant part of that, and there's a very steep learning curve across all stakeholders in actually understanding what I think needs to come out of that scenario analysis. And the TCFD's disclosures and also the guidelines are really quite broad and actually allow a lot of latitude in terms of what's provided. Personally, that's one of my bugbears, and I hope that industries will actually gravitate towards common sets of scenarios which actually allow for things like comparability. If you're an asset owner or an investor such as ourselves, who are acting as proxies to invested asset owners, you absolutely need comparability, and comparability on a fair basis, because you might wind up with the absurd notion where those companies who are actually doing a lot of work to disclose and actually putting evidence their risks are unfairly punished relative to those who do not.
We'll go into a bit more of that detail shortly. Sam, I just wanted to come to you just to give us a bit of a flavour of those scenarios, and so that we can get our heads into that space.
Sure, and I'm conscious of your reminder not to veer too much into jargon, so I'll do my best describing scenario analysis. It's one of those terms that conjures up images of complexity which aren't necessarily kind of reflective of the core of what's being talked about. In basic terms, scenarios are just a tool for grappling with uncertainty about the future. I mean, it's kind of easy to talk about what they're not. They're not forecasts of the future. They're not really hard projections of the future. They're meant to be narratives about different pathways your operating environment could take, different ways in which the world is important to you as a business might evolve. that you can use to reflect back on your strategy and your risk management processes to kind of interrogate what your exposures might look like, what your long-term performance might look like, what decisions you can take today to try and respond to the kinds of risks and opportunities that that scenario exercise might have brought up. So I think those kind of tools have been around in the business world, obviously, for a long time. I think the innovation here is the particular relevance of scenario analysis to the question of climate change, which, given the inherent uncertainty of all the different ways in which climate change will impact the physical world around us and in the transition economically, socially, environmentally, to a new world, scenario analysis is really well suited for. And that was one of the key insights of the TCFD report, was putting scenario analysis front and centre as one of the key things that organisations can do in a structured way to assess the materiality of some of the risks and opportunities that they face.
So for the work that you've done on this report, who's doing it well? Have you got some insights on that?
The short answer is that it's a pretty steep learning curve, as Dom said, for a lot of organisations that haven't done this.
I was looking for you just... Great comfort, I
have. Yeah, well, I'm thinking also, Dom provided a good reminder about numbers rather than words. I think in the Australian context, EY published a report a couple of months back that I think had counted 11 or 12 organisations only here that had done kind of sophisticated scenario analysis. And, you know, there's lots of encouraging stuff in some of those efforts, given that it's relatively early, at least in terms of the formal TCFD framework. It's also true to say that there's lots of ways in which these exercises so far are falling short. So in terms of the consistency of the assumptions that are used, in terms of the level of ambition on climate that they build in, I mean, most of them still fall well and truly short of the kinds of trajectories that would be consistent with meeting the Paris Agreement. Particular issue about whether these scenarios include consideration of physical risks, which are a really important part of this conversation to remember. It's not just about transition risk, it's about physical risks. As well, and you know, whether companies are disclosing actual impacts of that scenario analysis that they've reflected back onto their decisions and onto their strategy. So it's one thing to conduct an exercise and to put it in a nice glossy report, but it's another to, you know, show evidence of how you've built that into for what you're doing. So I mean, I think there are signs that the level of ambition and that the level of sophistication for scenario analysis are improving, and there's certainly a lot of expectation around that this year now that organisations have had a year to digest the recommendations of the TCFD. It remains to be seen what we see when those disclosures start coming out this year.
Dom, did you just want to pick up on that in terms of
the... look, it's very early days when it comes to disclosure, and there's a lot of flowery language that's used and not enough numbers. Before coming down, I was looking at a large global multinationals annual report that has had a go at integrating TCFD. And if you could just do a quick search on climate, you'll come up with 80 references, right? So climate's very big. And then you go down and have a look at what they actually disclose, what they talk about. And this company has run a 2-degree scenario and a 4-degree scenario. And they say that, yes, there by 2030 there will be a financial risk, that they can meet that, and that there will be no need for any change to their business plan. Like, you know, raise your hand if any of you actually think that that's a credible outcome. So there's some real issues that need to be attacked, and I think it comes back to some of the observations that were made by John Price earlier on around there may well be a fear for disclosing too much.
I'm going to bring Anna, you and Sarah in at this point because you're both nodding in. I think it sounds like this sounds like a familiar story to you. But are you finding, what are you reading into some of the descriptions you've seen in some of the scenarios?
Yeah, I agree it is early days.
Yep.
Perfect is the enemy of good. Everyone's trying their best. Or not in all cases. Some people aren't trying at all, but everyone's trying. Look at what's happening in Europe. The French have got a couple of years on us in particular because they've had mandatory reporting against similar standards to the TCFD under the French Article 173 for a couple of years. So there are better examples better in the sense that they've had an extra year or two of that evolution and that learning process. If you look at reports from companies like AXA and Allianz, mm-hmm. And even ironically Statoil, which I think has just renamed itself Equinox because they want to get oil out of their name, are good examples of companies globally that are leading on that front. I think, though, with my asset owner hat on, I think we've got to get a lot better at calling BS. Because
sounds
if you
like
are,
that's around
if
now,
you are absolutely, because if you are doing a tick box exercise where you are impressed with a 5-page glossy that uses the word climate 80 times and runs the line that we have seen over a number of years from very heavily exposed companies to say that we have no exposure, we need to start calling that out. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, chucking a hissy fit and divesting tomorrow, but communicating our own expectations in a more sophisticated way and putting them on notice that that doesn't cut it anymore. And it's not a matter of this is a new issue that they haven't had time to digest. It's something that they have been on notice, all companies around the world have been on notice of for a very long time, and I think patience is starting to run very short.
From the local perspective, it was interesting to hear John talk about the concern around forward-looking disclosures and so forth. Is there a more sophisticated kind of understanding of this, does it hang on something as basic as that people who directors are concerned about that in making those disclosures?
With my corporate lawyer hat on, it's a common pushback we get, but it completely misunderstands both the law in relation to misleading disclosure in respect of forward-looking statements and also the role of scenario planning and stress testing. It's a non-argument. It's an ill-informed and dangerous argument, I think, for directors to be running. And certainly I think it's a far, far higher risk, not wanting to put enforcement words in John's mouth, a far, far higher risk to not say anything, because then what are you representing to the market? It's not an issue for you.
So what should directors be doing now to arm themselves?
How much time have we got?
Well, you just come back to basics.
You just come back to basics. Yeah. Due care and diligence. What does due care and diligence look like? The 5 E's. Firstly, educate yourself about the issue. Educate yourself enough that you can have alarm bell knowledge so that you can inquire of management and relevant experts about it. You then need to examine the information that comes back, critically evaluate it, and express yourself. Ask questions. It's the same robust process that you apply to any other financial risk issue. What the actual answer is going to differ for every board. But it's the same process of robust interrogation, whether you're thinking about cyber risk, whether you're thinking about demographic change, whether you're thinking about climate change. There's no magic to it.
On the first E, on educate, the report that's been published today has some suggested checklists and a example scenario analysis in it that was produced by my team at ClimateWorks, and it's by no means the only way to do it, but it's an example of what are the different things that might change in a business context under different climate change scenarios, and that's everything from global drivers, demographic change, energy system drivers relevant to the business. And then that in itself can provide some tools for thinking about some of the what-if scenarios. And as you both noted, and so did John, the power of scenarios is simply a good business tool. Mm-hmm. It's useful for disruption of any sense, not just disruption from climate change risk and opportunity. It allows, certainly at ClimateWorks, we found our own experience of undertaking scenarios, which began over 5 years ago in the lead up to preparing for Paris, science around emissions reduction move from annual targets, incremental improvements of 2 or 5 or 20% over a finite number of years, to a cumulative carbon budget notion, when we understood that actually stabilising global warming at any temperature, 2 degrees or even higher, means balancing out the emissions we add to the environment with the emissions we remove. And that balancing out, that net zero goal, is the only goal for stabilising global warming. And the temperature is simply the mathematical outcome of how long it takes. When we did that, there was a massive mindset shift. And that's how the scenarios can be helpful. The end goal is defined in the scenario, the 2 degrees end goal, or a 4 degrees in that, in the case that Sam and Dom use. And the 2 degrees or 4 degrees, both of them have a net zero emissions endpoint. The only difference being, how many decades from now is that? And then you can unlock your mind and start thinking very differently. It's not incremental from where are we today. It's working backwards from where is that point and what does it mean for how we get there and how we might get there. So you can run any sort of what-if scenarios to stress test that. What if 3D printing happens and takes off? What if metal recycling happens more? What happens to those sectors in this economy? What if autonomous vehicles really take off or really don't? What if? And a scenario doesn't have to be right. By definition, it won't be. But when you run many of them, you can then be much more open-minded about preparing for possible disruptions and be less afraid of them when you can see that you might prepare well for them and find opportunity in those as well.
You've picked the important word in this, because we do tend to focus on risk, and rightly so, because we've got legal duties and so forth. But you've just described something which expands huge opportunity. Be interested to get takes from the panel in terms of the opportunities that you've seen, the organisations that have that zero focus, net zero focus, and then working back from that, what are some of the opportunities and the way they're getting geared up for that?
Well, the gentlemen think of some examples. There's a process opportunity even in it. That one CEO I love to quote of a multinational found that in simply shifting from an incremental improvement, so KPIs used to be, let's be 2% better this year than last. And that applied to water efficiency, and then it applied to carbon emissions reductions, as well as other financial metrics, of course. When they understood the carbon goal and realised it was a step change that was needed, they set themselves a 30% goal at the end of 5 years rather than a 2% annual goal. And they achieved it faster and got there more than when they'd set the annual goal, because they unlocked a different type of thinking. And that's in a food services manufacturing business. Nothing particularly climate related. They make yogurt.
Tell me more. And while Sam, you've got some thoughts, and we're going to take questions. We'll come shortly to you, and Sam, and Dom to pick up on that, and then we'll go to questions. Thanks.
Sure. I don't have an example specific as yogurt, unfortunately. But I mean, I think there are both the kinds of examples and opportunities that would come to mind, like in the energy space. If you look at all the, you know, the key energy focus scenarios, the big transitions and opportunities in renewables, in energy efficiency. I mean, these are things that are going to cascade through our economy and our you know, business community in all kinds of different ways, in a physical way, like directly in terms of energy efficiency products and services. There's a whole litany of different opportunities in that space. And then there's the more or less anticipated or less conventional innovations around, you know, 3D printing and autonomous vehicles and a whole litany of other things which could quite radically change, you know, how we think about the climate problem, but also have all these different spillover effects into the way we do business generally. So, I mean, I think shifting the conversation a little bit to, as we described before, the carrot as well as the stick is an important part of this, and it's not all just about risks.
Well, Dom, I don't know, the risk of asking who's in your portfolio for your zero carbon assets.
Yeah, look so we've got companies in there like you know, Microsoft or Apple, so pretty heavy in the tech space, and a lot of these companies actually are quite forward-looking in the way that they think about the consumption of their goods and services from beginning to end, and put in place all sorts of mechanisms to try and achieve that. But just winding back to your broader question around opportunities, etc. And if I could just make some pretty big comments around TCFD, and I think some of the challenges around the scenario analysis and what is being provided to ultimately markets and consumers of scenario analysis like myself, is that for the scenario analysis to be decision useful and comparable, you need a comparability of scenarios. And I think a lot of the discussion to date around the world has heavily focused on the emitters of carbon, which has tended to focus then on transition risk. And it's become a very lopsided view of the world. Because if they don't get it right, the ones who actually pay the price are all of those other companies who haven't been caught up in that analysis, which is to say all of the companies not in the energy space who will be impacted dramatically by the physical risks. And thankfully, I was really glad to see the coverage of physical risks in the paper that was published overnight, because it's a big area of discussion which isn't being talked about. So everyone's happy to talk about turning off coal-fired power plants, but what if you get it wrong, or if that doesn't transpire? What happens to valuations of companies that are hit by that? So think about large multinationals that might be involved in chocolate, right? What might happen to their production? What might happen to their businesses? We might be talking about 20, 30, 40, 50% of earnings being wiped out. So the discussion is quite lopsided, and all I'm getting at is you actually need some base scenarios to be published against which to compare. And perhaps the base scenarios that people need to be publishing might be something like a 4-degree temperature increase or a 5-degree temperature increase, from which to then measure the 2-degree scenario against. What that would actually show is that there are significant benefits to investment outcomes outside of the carbon consumptive world. And it's a spectrum which is not properly provided to asset markets that the whole range of the asset spectrum needs to be looked at. And there are huge beneficiaries from moving from a 4 or 5 degree world to a 2 degree world or 1.5 degree world. And that debate, that discussion, that physical risk exploration hasn't been discussed enough.
There's a couple of other examples in the food and property. I could illustrate one of the questions I'm thinking about if you want to.
And your point about the to get to 2 degrees, we've got to halve emissions, energy intensity by 2030. That's right. Yeah. Let's go to questions. Please identify yourself. Keep it.
Joe, maybe.
Joe, there's a microphone coming up, so just get with this. Thanks.
Maybe. This is about change. And I listened to all this, and I admire the people who are doing this, but this isn't easy. The bank that I worked for, when I worked for, I wrote the lending manual. And in that lending manual, one section was called environment. I put lots of things in there, but one thing I didn't put in there is the very thing that you're talking about now, and that is energy. Now, the problem we have now is this is just you. This involves the companies, obviously, businesses, regulators, auditors, and banks, and I'll explain that in a moment. And of course, the message I get to the companies. How can directors be held accountable for identifying and disclosing climate change risks when our PM doesn't understand it or doesn't want to do anything about it, and the government doesn't want to do anything about it? So you're going to have one hell of a problem there with ASIC and APRA to get into this.
Okay.
And what, I'm not finished. Let me just finish it. All right, I thought about
that's one question. Let's take
no,
that
it's
one.
Not a question. Well, let me just finish this off.
All right.
How can the directors be held accountable for this? And what are you going to do with banks, energy businesses, packaging companies, fast food companies that use straws and so forth, the Pizza Huts, and worst of all, home heating, where we should be putting those things on our roofs to lessen the dependence on energy.
Thank you. Would you like to take that?
I'll take it. Turn this on? Yep. Okay. The first question about the PM, without making any political statements at all, if you look at what the financial risk implications associated with climate change are, federal policy is one very, very small bit of the financial equation. You've got physical risk, both extreme, catastrophic, and gradual onset. You have got regulatory risk. You know, three of the gentlemen in this room are the bearers of let's call them stewards of one aspect of that risk. You've got state government making law. You've got stakeholder risks, both in terms of your customers and in terms of your investors. In all of that, federal policy is only a very, very small part, an important part, but only very, very small. So they only make one bit of the laws. And the thing is, markets are shifting well ahead. It's almost becoming irrelevant. If you look at what banks are doing, including in Australia, the financial services sector is leading on this. We've seen an explosion in the last 6 months, particularly out of Europe, in novel approaches to finance, where there is a direct relationship between the rate of interest that you pay, including Danone, our yogurt friends, on €2 billion worth of their debt, a direct relationship between interest rates and their hitting their sustainability targets. And to my mind, when that starts mainstreaming, where financial institutions directly link your interest rates to what you are doing, I think very, very quickly we're going to have corporations around the world starting to adjust their behaviours accordingly, because otherwise they're going to leave value on the table. And that's not good for anyone.
And this is where the opportunity comes in as well. So the consumer sentiment is shifting at the same time, and this relates to the social licence point. And some of the examples I've seen in the property sector through the Green Building Council include, for example, Mervac, a residential property development that's trialling a no-bills house. And it came out of a combination of rising electricity prices, but also a need to reduce the emissions and energy use and water use of the house. And then it's turned into a new proposition, which is an opportunity for that business. What began as addressing a risk is now an opportunity for them to differentiate in that market. Stockland, a shopping centre property developer, now advertises that if you have an electric vehicle, you can drive from Melbourne to Cairns and recharge all the way at any Stockland retail centre. And so a lot of discussion around scenarios and risk management then unleashes opportunity thinking, and the consumers are ready for it. These businesses have certainly decided to invest ahead of any law saying so.
Yeah. Question over here. Thank you.
Ian Dunlop, thanks very much for all the comments, and I'm very glad to see all this happening, particularly the regulator interest and the progress we're making with these sort of reports. But could I just sort of raise a couple of practical issues? The climate risk we're facing is far greater than anybody is acknowledging officially. We are now at the point where the things that have been expressed as concerns for 15 years ago are now actually happening. If you look at the leading edge science, we're faced with an existential risk today which is being locked in right now by the fact that we are continuing to expand the use of fossil fuels in the global economy, and particularly in Australia. Now, we say we're just a small player in the game, 1.3%. In total terms, we are the sixth largest carbon polluter in the world, and we'll soon be the fourth if you include our exports. Now, it's good to hear risk is now being picked up as something we seriously have to address. If the directors are going to do it, they need to look at what the real risk actually is. And it's not the one we're being told by the IEA or by the IPCC. It's much greater than that. Now, if you look around, to raise the gentleman's point across here, we're not going to see political leadership on this. It's pretty clear that neither side of politics actually have the ability to address this size of problem. It's going to have to come from the community, it's going to have to come from business and from regulators. And from investors, but obviously, as Sam said, we can't expect the regulators to do it all. So it's going to fall back very much on investors and the community. So my question here to the panel is, how are we going to speed this up to face reality rather than just playing games? Because it does concern me that the whole TCFD approach and scenarios, it's all good, but it, I'm afraid, looks as if it's going to become a box-ticking exercise. We've done scenarios, we've been there, climate must be under control. And it's not. So if you look at the actual figures today, emissions are going up at a rate of knots. We have all the rhetoric about renewables, and that's going gangbusters, that's great. But if you look at what's happened in the last 10 years, the biggest expansion has been in oil and gas. And emissions are climbing. They should be going down right now.
Thanks.
So a complete disconnect. How do we fix it?
Thanks, Ian. It's very important. Yes. Who'd like to respond?
Thank you, and thanks, Ian. Unfortunately, I don't think I have a comprehensive answer to that question. It's a very difficult one, and this the broader question, which I think underlies what you're asking, is balancing a sense of urgency to respond to a big problem we can all see coming, and where all the science is pointing to the need for pretty much immediate responses in order to get us on a trajectory under which we'll be able to keep global warming 1.5 to 2 degrees. Balancing that with practical, pragmatic things that we think we can do now to do some good. It's a very hard one to resolve. Laying my cards on the table, for what it's worth, I think that if we could get a bunch of leading corporates and investors in Australia to get really serious about engaging with the science and the economics on robust 1.5 to 2 degree scenarios, that in and of itself would be an important contribution, both to how we think about these things publicly, but also to the policy development process, because the first thing that happens when you start engaging with the science is that you realise how quickly the costs stack up of bad policy. So I think, you know, those two things could make an important contribution. Whether that kind of contribution is sufficient to address the concern that you have and the imperative that we all feel is an open question.
Thank you. Anyone else would respond to that?
I don't think there's any silver bullet. I mean, and as you know, Ian, this is an area that you've worked in tirelessly and had a huge influence in the last decade. But I, call me naive, but I actually think that we have reached a bit of a tipping point because of the fact it has now started in the mainstream financial community and the mainstream corporate community, and the learning curve is so steep. So I don't think we're going to see the same gradual realisation that we have seen over the last X number of years. I think it's going to accelerate rapidly. Whether or not it's going to accelerate quickly enough is another question. But I think if companies start integrating their learning, which will be exponential, if we continue to call laggards out, and if we do continue what we have started in terms of looking at this through a financial risk lens for everyone, don't care about the environment, care about polar bears, care about the community, it's money, then we can catch everyone, no matter what their philosophy on it is.
There's also a shift. So I completely agree with the challenge of the question, and that's why we're all here on a rainy night. Giving our careers to this issue, and it's going to take all types. I often view the change system as an ecosystem, and it needs the analysis and the investors as well as the activists and all in between. A couple of shifts that I've observed in the narrative, and it's a new one, and it's only, I'd say, emerging still, but that's in a move from the conversation from energy into food and land. Mm. So ClimateWorks has always spoken of solutions to climate change and solutions to reducing emissions across four pillars, the first three being energy related and the fourth being in relation to land. And now I find the food and land conversation appearing more prominently in a lot of the circles and research networks and stakeholder events. And one statistic that will, I think, motivate a whole lot more interest in that is recent research from CSIRO as part of a global network that mapped the global population projections out to 2050, and the planetary boundaries that we understand, limits to soil health, water and air, and try to analyse how can we feed that population, what are the scenarios for feeding that population while staying within those planetary boundaries. And they ran all sorts of what-ifs, including what if agricultural productivity got as good as we see it could become, what if everybody went vegan. And they actually ran some quite extreme scenarios, and not one achieved feeding the population mid-century without tipping a planetary boundary or at least one of the water, soil or air limitations. So the researchers' conclusion was step change is needed, not an acceleration of the current path, and innovation and R&D is needed. So there are explorations of petri dish protein, for example, etc. But that conversation, I suspect, might engage a broader audience than even the financial, the power of financial investors has so far engaged. And then I think then we all have to get our skates on and translate the lessons between the two sectors, because that sense that the next generation will sort this out doesn't work when the climate science says the next two decades are the ones that could tip us over. So we can't wait for the next era. We're going to have to accelerate that, but hopefully broadening the conversation to more human impacts might engage a wider audience.
I'm looking at time and I'm afraid we've run out of time. I think that's a very sobering conclusion to our discussion. I was going to mention Legal & General, which one of the biggest investment houses, which is in Europe, about to start voting out chairs of boards who they believe are laggards on this issue. So I'm imagining us, I thought 5 years ago, looking at where we're heading, that we might be heading somewhere a bit more serious. I'm trying to imagine where we are. If we imagine ourselves tonight in 5 years, looking back at what steps we now take, I would hope that we can start to do some of the step change required under these scenarios. I'd like to thank you all. Thank you for coming out on a wet night. Thank you, Anna, Sarah, Don and Sam, for your very thoughtful discussion. To Anne and yourself, gentlemen, thank you. Please put your hands together and thank our panel. I recommend, before we finish, I recommend you get your copy online of the full report and take this time with you tonight. And I would like to welcome Matt Cumming and Mike to close proceedings for tonight.